Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Yana Byers, your host, and I'm here today with Barbara Rosenwein, Professor Emerita at Loyola University of Chicago, to talk about her new book, Love, A History in Five Fantasies, out this year, 2021, with Polity Press. Hello, Barbara, and welcome to the program.
Hello, Yana, and I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thanks for joining me. I'm very excited to talk to you. So how are you this morning? Are you in Chicago?
I'm near Chicago. I'm in the neighborhood of Evanston, which is a stone's throw from Chicago.
Yes. I think most of our audience is probably aware of Evanston, home of another fine school.
Indeed it is, yes. So Northwestern is in my backyard.
Yeah, absolutely.
A library were in my backyard.
that would be nice, but that's not so bad. And tell me, how's Chicago this morning? How's it going?
It's actually very sunny and getting warmer. And by Thursday, it might even be in the 60s, which would be, somewhere around 18 degrees centigrade.
Yeah. That's, it's apocalyptic, this climate change, but it does make for nice November afternoons.
Yes. Well, we shall see.
Anyway. Yeah. Okay. Weather's never reliable, but that particular place is a bit sketchy. All right. So book wise, interview wise, turning from the ever interesting weather to the actual reason we're here. So my first job when I interview is always to try to situate the current work in the author's academic and intellectual trajectory. And so that's what I'm on about now. But I feel like we need to back up a bit, and I want to talk about your career as a whole as this beautiful demonstration of how an academic and how an intellectual can grow and develop if they get space, support, and can just are left to do what they want to do.
Thank you. I've been very lucky. I started out as a medievalist, and I taught many, many classes on medieval history, and my own specialization was medieval monasticism, and particularly the monks of Cluny. But the monks of Cluny present, as do all historical questions, some really, really interesting, deep issues. And one of them for me was why? Why did these monks spend all of their time, or nearly all of their time, in the church praying? Other monks spend a lot of time in the church praying, but not all of their time. So I really began to get interested in the whys. Of course, throughout my life, I've always been interested in whys. Most of us are from about the age of three. Then I was chairing a session at the American Historical Association that had nothing to do with medieval monasticism, but rather was about the social construction of anger in the Middle Ages. At that time, I had no idea what social constructionism was. I'm telling you right here. But as I listened to the conversation and the papers and the commentary afterwards, I realized this is a field of enormous fascination that I really would like to get into. And as you say, I was lucky. My institution let me do it. My institution didn't care. I wanted to talk about medieval emotions. Fine. Wanted to give courses on medieval emotions. Fine. That led me to want to think about the history of emotions in general. And again, I was able to pursue that as I wished. And then now, you know, I'm retired, so I get to do whatever I want. I embarked first on this. Most of my work was on complexes of emotions in the Middle Ages, and then I moved out a little bit into the ancient world on one end of the Middle Ages and into the early modern period on the other. And what I was interested in talking about varieties of what I call emotional communities in these periods. That is, you cannot generalize a whole society is angry or violent, or you've got different groups of that value different emotions, or even the same emotions differently, even at the same time. And that kind of coexistence of different emotional communities, valuations of emotions, expressions of emotions. We all know that there are some people who express their emotions more volubly than others, and we may feel comfortable with those people or less comfortable with them. And in a way, that gives you an idea of what I mean by emotional communities, where people agree more or less on the emotions that they want to express, the ways that they express them, and the values that they attach to various emotions. Anyway, by the time I retired, I felt I was ready to undertake a really larger arc of historical studies. And I chose for that not emotional communities in general, which is, would be a 9,000-page book, but right, rather one emotion. I chose anger and wrote a book about anger, the conflicted history of an emotion. And that took me from the Buddha to Twitter. And then, only then, did I feel ready to start with love. And love turned out to be the most difficult topic I'd ever tried to work on. And I spent so much time and trashed so many different outlines for this book that I almost gave up on it. And it was in the process of giving up on it that I realized, well, but there are certain themes, certain memes, certain stories that just keep coming up over and over again in all of my reading. Can I organize these to come up with a history of love? Not telling people what love is, but telling myself and others what love has been, what it has meant, how it has been somehow shaped and managed, at least within the Western tradition. I'd love to know other traditions, but I lack the languages, I lack the expertise. But I'm comfortable with many Western languages, not all of them, of course, and the whole arc of Western history. So that's what the book really takes up. And maybe I've gone too far with your question, but anyway, that's how it first institutional support, and then the sense that I can go where I want to go.
No, that is exactly what I wanted. That's it. That's exactly where I wanted this to go. And that's wonderful. That is such a great story, right? Because there are a lot of colleagues who don't get to do that, right? Mm-hmm. For whatever reason, institutional support, they're boxed, they're scared. I think it's also, it is scary to take on a new field and a whole new historiography. And you start as a medievalist, right? Rhinoceros bound, Cluny, and like, you've got this. You are a medievalist. And then you're like, how about emotion? Which is this whole new historiography, a whole new set of methodologies, as it turns out, new languages. That's really brave as well.
Thanks. It's fun too.
Yeah.
And when I just the other day, I was looking at the work of a very respected colleague. And that colleague had started with one topic and was still writing about that topic. And I thought, how can he do that? How can he stand to do that? But on the other hand, every topic does unfold with infinite new aspects. And so I do understand, and it isn't really a mystery. That every topic, if you get into it, is an infinity of topics. So,
yeah, and you know this, medievalists, like I'm sure we have friends in common who, you know, they wrote their books, and you look at the titles and you're like, yeah, these, you've just written the same book 3 or 4 times here, or 7 or 10, but they're not, of course, the same books at all. They're not. They're wonderful. But it is, and I think I admire that. I admire the ability to bore deeply into a topic.
Yeah, so do I. But I think after a while, the monks of Cluny began to, dare I say, bore me a little bit. And so it was time to move.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah. Well, and I'm sure there were moments when you were with anger, for sure, and then with love, that you were taken back, at least in spirit, to your monks.
Yeah. Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, anger has a whole section on monastic cursing, which is both angry and void of anger. It's a very interesting way of handling one's opposition to enemies. It really, so yes, definitely. And in the love book, of course, the monks, not so much the Cluniacs, but the Cistercians, mm-hmm. are obsessed with love, erotic imagery of love for God. So the Song of Songs becomes mm-hmm. Cistercian monks, 12th century monks, who really oppose the Cluniacs, but also are very much like the Cluniacs. They elaborate a whole affective monastic life, dwelling upon the feelings of the individual worshiper, the monk, for Christ. And their abbot, Saint Bernard, wrote numerous sermons that we can all explore in English, in Dutch, in any language you like, because they're all translated, but originally in Latin, explore the Song of Songs as the longing of the soul for God, the longing of the believer for Christ. And he glories in the erotic and sensual possibilities of that love.
So I think this takes us to an understand, this place, because you select five persistent narratives of love, and I want to get to that. But, this is a narrative of love that makes some sense. But I want to talk about this process too, before we get there, where you say, I'm quoting here, you begin to see some of the memes coalesce. And so what they're coalescing into stories, into, you call them into ultimately fantasies. How does this happen? What does that mean?
Well, psychologists are beginning to talk about this, the importance of narratives that we have to organize the understanding of the feelings that we have. Normally, the psychologists talk about the narratives that we have deriving from our own lives, our parents, how they brought us up, our school experiences, our love experiences. We make sense of all of these experiences by telling ourselves stories. What I began to see is that the process is not just intimate like that, but that we ourselves draw on cultural narratives that we see on television, that we hear on radio, that we read about in books, that we learn about in school, and that our friends tell us about, that we hear in songs that we listen to, music, that we look at art. All of these things are part of our lives. It's not just our parents who bring us up. It's our culture as well. And some of us may be more immersed in more profound elements of that culture, but we're all part of the culture, and we pick and choose from it what makes sense for us. And so I was interested in adding to what the psychologists say about the importance of fantasies and narratives in the way we organize our feelings and our understanding of who we are, our own identity, I wanted to add to that also the legacy of history, not just dates and facts. In fact, very few dates and facts, but the memes that have come up to us, the stories that have come up to us via all the media that we have at our disposal today, and not just books, of course, but as I say, television and radio, and so on. So that's where the idea came from.
Mm-hmm. Right. So we see storytelling as a means of not just reporting, not just reminding us, but in fact of creating.
Right. Absolutely. That's a really good way to put it.
That's so
we tell ourselves stories, but as we do that, we do change them. And we know that that's true of oral stories. We know that, for example, the Epic of Sundiata, from Mali, is told in so many different ways by the various oral reporters of it, the recorders of it, the singers of it. We know that Homer must have started out that way, although what has come down to us is one Homer. Mm-hmm. So we do that. We are our own Homers. And we do that in our lives with telling ourselves stories, telling our children's stories, telling our friends' stories, and telling, it is a social process, but it's also an internal process as we make sense of what's happening to us.
I find that fascinating, that we use these stories we have to explain to ourselves what's going on. And then when we relate that to our friends, families, loved ones, soon to be exes, we're using these stories to demonstrate it, to explain what we mean, and then just tweaking the meaning a little or reaffirming it, right? That's so fascinating.
Yeah, because we each bring something individual. Our upbringing, no one's upbringing is exactly the same. Even twins will say that. I happen to have twins, Frank and Jessica. We're twins, my kids. And they will tell you entirely different stories about their upbringing and about their schooling, about their friendships, because no one experiences even the same context in exactly the same way. That's the marvelous thing about individuality, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And then how we translate that into a society, which is pretty cool. Okay, so you coalesce, these memes coalesced for you around five different ideas. Yeah, like-mindedness, transcendence, obligation, obsession, and insatiability. And none of these were what I was expecting. But when I opened this book, what will these five fantasies be? This was fabulous and brand new, and I found it so exciting. Is this what you expected?
Well, no. As I told you, I trashed a million outlines. But I knew that I wanted to talk about different kinds of loves. And what I came to realize as I thought about it was that, for example, like-mindedness does largely, not entirely, but largely compass the love involved in friendships. Mm-hmm. Whereas obligation is more the issue, the constant refrain of long-term relationships. Insatiability, on the contrary, it's about cruising, and in a way, the insatiability is a little. It's not more modern. There are fantasies of insatiability long before the modern period, indeed in the ancient world. But the emphasis on it becomes modern. The idea of cruising is much more prevalent today than in the ancient world or in the middle, certainly in the Middle Ages. Well, you have the idea, but let's just say there is a certain approval or at least toleration of it in the modern period. So partly what I wanted to do was also follow through with ancient like-mindedness, medieval transcendence and obligation and obsession. But that really takes us also into Romantic period, the modern, the early modern, modern period, and then the insatiability. There's no hard and fast periodization here, but it does. The book does sort of move from ancient to modern. Mm-hmm. That's why I organized it that way. However, the chapter titles got changed around quite a bit.
I can imagine, yeah.
Yeah, while I was writing it, so that if you were surprised, I'd be interested in knowing what you had expected.
Not very well thought out, but I assumed I would think I was going to see Eros and Amakitia and kind of
Yeah. So my first outline was a romantic love, friendship, love of nature, love, a universal love of mankind. But it just was impossible, because the reason it was impossible was because I kept repeating myself. Friendship kept moving along the same tracks as romantic love. So I just would start out with the ancient world, move to the Middle Ages, get to the modern, and then go back to the ancient world. It just didn't work. I mean, it was boring. So that had to be scrapped.
So in our periodization, though, I mean, so if we think of like-mindedness, kind of the idea of a oneness, a togetherness there, you know, that there's something that works in the ancient world. Does that still work? Is that still in force in our modern era?
Yes. I mean, people are really still talking about finding the best friend who understands everything that you're thinking, who agrees, who's on the same page with you, with regard to everything. You don't need to talk because they understand. They don't need to talk because you understand. That is an ideal today. And actually, that chapter I start with a modern TV program that I've forgotten the name of it already, Enlightened, yeah, where the protagonist really thinks she's found her soulmate, but she's disappointed in the end because the soulmate has her own agenda, and our protagonist realizes her agenda isn't the same as the soulmate's, and so they part. But the fantasy persists. The fantasy that I will find someone with whom I am just so perfectly in tune that we will dance together through life. And indeed, musicians do find that. I mean, I don't know if you've played in a group. A band or a musical group, but that sense of harmony, not just musical harmony, but that you're all working together toward the same goal. You understand one another. You are in sync. That's a fantastic feeling. So no wonder people wish, and some people seem to actually find that in their daily life. But it is a very persistent fantasy.
Well, that's the other thing with these fantasies, though, is even that they're never full time. You never always have this. There's something you can always strive for.
That's right. That's right. And if there's a takeaway, if there's sort of a is there a therapy embedded in this? The therapy embedded is, don't feel terrible if the fantasy doesn't work every minute. because, you know, reality intrudes and reality can change the fantasy and make it richer. It's okay, you know. You can also, none of these fantasies are in their own compartments. They flow into one another. It's not like the person who's looking for the like-minded other doesn't also have the fantasy at time or even at the same time of the love as transcendence, of this love needs nothing of the world, or that this love I can't get enough of. Mm-hmm. So these fantasies move together, they combine, and the full history of love has to be seen in the interbraiding of all the five fantasies. And even there, you don't have the full history. You've got a good sketch with a lot of the colors, but there's still more to be added.
The way the metaphors you're using to talk about it, it reminds me of another thing I wanted to discuss with you, which is your incredibly wide source material, which of we're talking about classic tragedy, the stories we all know. But I mean, there is somewhere, I don't know if it's the first image, but the first one that comes to mind is you have a New Yorker cartoon.
Yeah. Well, as I say, I wanted this, although it doesn't go from Buddha to Twitter, I wanted this to go from the ancient world to the modern. I am a part of the modern world, and I'm writing to an audience that's part of the modern world. So I'm not only asking about what was historical, but where are we today? What kind of an environment are we living in today? And that New Yorker cartoon is so perfect because it depicts a knight in armor with a sword, a damsel in a tower, surrounded, threatened by a dragon, and then it upsets our expectations entirely because the knight says, before I rescue you, what are your financial goals?
How do you feel about kids?
So that really turned out to be such a wonderful image for me, a metaphor for me, for the idea that we have these fantasies and that can be disrupted then by a cartoonist who sees the humor in you might say, juxtaposing a modern realist position with a medieval romantic stance. So I spent a lot of time in this book. I read a lot of different things, and I left out a lot. I had a whole chapter on Pocahontas and John Smith for a while, but it just didn't fit because I didn't know enough about the Powhatan idea of love. I left that out. So I left out a lot, and I've got on my bookshelf all kinds of Jamestown narratives, and there's so much. I mean, everybody thinks about love, and everybody has written about love, and there's sort of nothing that doesn't touch on love. So it was a challenge to stay very focused on five different fantasies and leave it there.
this struck me it's all love too. You know, the way we feel about our families is love. As you write about our relationship with the divine is love. Yes. And then of course the eternal obsession with romantic love, sexual love.
Yeah.
I don't know how you would ever stop reading for this book.
Well, right. Luckily my publisher said around 50,000 words. Well,
that would be
and to some degree, as I continue to read, the themes continue to repeat themselves. So I felt okay, although I haven't included every source in this book, I've covered five major fantasies. They are not the only ones that we have today. And so maybe, you know, if I had a publisher who said, how about 200,000 words, I would have added a few more fantasies. But the important thing was to cover a lot of ground, to read enough to know, okay, the next thing I read is going to fit in here or would have to go in a chapter that I haven't even begun, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That sounds like a tough book to write, but fun. It seems like a lot of fun to research anyway.
Absolutely. So much fun. I miss it already.
Well, it sounds like you can do it again. It sounds like there are places you can go. And that's, before I get to my very last question, which is basically that one, I wanted to ask you a personal question you can opt out of, but was there something that really spoke to you? Was there a place, a chapter where you really felt at home? You were like, this is my chapter.
Yes, I really felt at home with the obsession chapter, which really gets going with troubadours, whom I just adore. And then, as a matter of fact, I took some courses in Old Occitan so that I could read the troubadours in the original. And I just loved their playfulness, their obsessive stance, but also their poking fun at themselves. I absolutely rejoiced in that kind of both immersion and distancing that they were able to allow themselves. It got a little murkier with the romantics. Mm-hmm. Poor Werther killing himself. You know that he didn't poke fun at himself.
No, they are utterly humorless.
Yeah. Oh, but I really enjoyed that chapter and could have spent more time on it, but
This really felt at home. That was a place where, as you know, a late medieval, early modernist, that place really felt right to me too.
Yes, is that where you felt? Okay.
I was like, I get this love.
Okay.
Yeah. That makes sense. But it is all a culture I understand. This, and you know, this is a thing, as I clearly really enjoyed the book, but I kept thinking, I don't know anyone who wouldn't want to read it. It will speak to everyone. Someone, you'll be able to find something that you find really compelling and really truthful, and something that makes you kind of shake your head. Like, this is a book that really speaks to Western culture. So well done.
Thank you so much.
It was a really lovely. All right. So what are you working on now? Because I don't think, looking at your CV, knowing your career as I do not think it's nothing. I'm certain there's another book happening right now.
Well, it isn't happening right now because I'm turning to a very scholarly paper that I'm hoping to give in Spoleto, Italy in the spring. Oh, may that happen. But when that... but when I finish that scholarly paper, I'm going to turn to the emotions of old age, the emotions that people have about old people and the emotions that elderly people have, but it'll again be a history. So it's not just old age today or anything like that, but I'll start with, you know, Cicero, De Senectudine, and on from there. There's a lot of stuff on old age embedded in poetry, in classics like, for example, the Decameron. I just recently read the Decameron and found all kinds of interesting things in there having to do with old people, witches, of course, and the whole fear of old ladies, ugliness, and what that means, what wrinkles mean. I'm interested in how this has been static, but also how it changes over time.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Yeah, I love that. I'm interested right now myself in senescence and the like. This idea of when disability and aging and the conflation thereof. That's a fascinating topic. That'll be really fun. Also, probably a tiny bit depressing, but
very depressing. Yes, because you do have to talk about disease and death. And anyway.
Yeah. I mean, that's the plan. That's how it goes. That's why we're here. So, all right. I cannot thank you enough for taking some time to talk to me today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Wonderful. And I will be in touch when to talk about the aging book as well. So keep me in mind.
All right. I will. Thank you so much.
Thank you.